have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Jean, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, January 4th, 2026 issue of the front section of the New York Times on Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. After seizing Maduro, Trump says U.S. will run Venezuela. A raid caps off months-long campaign against leader. This article is by Eric Schmidt, Tyler Pager, Anatoly Karamenev, and Carol Rosenberg. President Trump said on Saturday that the United States had captured the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, and was flying him out of Venezuela, the stunning culmination of a months-long campaign by the Trump administration to oust the authoritarian leader. The United States would, quote, run the country until proper transition of power could be arranged, the president said hours later, raising the prospect of an open-ended occupation. U.S. forces seized Mr. Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, Mr. Trump said in a social media post at 4:21 a.m. Officials said the raid was led by helicopter-borne special operation forces. In an interview Saturday morning on Fox News, Mr. Trump said that the soldiers had captured the couple in their fortified residence and that he had watched the operation on video as it happened. He said that the couple had been taken to the USS Iwo Jima, one of the American warships that had been prowling the Caribbean. They were expected to be flown to the United States to appear in court. Attorney General Pam Bondi said Mr. Maduro and Ms. Flores had been indicted on drug and weapons charges in New York and will soon face the full wrath of American justice. The remarkable seizure of a country's leader by another country brought immediate comparison to other landmark moments in recent American military history, including the capture of Saddam Hussein of Iraq in 2003, and Manuel Noriega of Panama in 1990, and the killing of Osama bin Laden in 2011. A CIA source within the Venezuelan government monitored the location of Mr. Maduro in the days and moments before his capture, according to people briefed on the operation. The people said that the agency produced the intelligence that led to the capture of Mr. Maduro, monitoring his position and movements with a fleet of stealth drones that provided near-constant monitoring over Venezuela, in addition to the information provided by its Venezuelan source. General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said at a news conference that U.S. warplanes had dismantled Venezuelan air defenses so that the American military helicopters could go into Caracas to extract Mr. Maduro and his wife. Mr. Trump said that Caracas was in darkness, implying that the Americans had cut the power. General Kane said the helicopters had taken fire from Venezuelan forces, but that none were lost. The whole operation lasted about 2 hours and 20 minutes, he said. They knew we were coming, Mr. Trump said at the news conference Saturday morning, arguing the Venezuelan military was quickly overwhelmed. Not a single American service member was killed, he said, though earlier he suggested there were injuries resulting from the strikes on the helicopter. Venezuelan officials said that Venezuelans had been killed in the operation. Mr. Maduro, a self-described socialist, had led Venezuela since 2013, and the Biden administration accused him of stealing the election that kept him in power last year. Mr. Trump offered no details about how the United States would oversee Venezuela or for how long. It was not clear whether it would involve the presence of U.S. military forces, the president did not rule it out, or the installation of a pliant government. Asked who was running Venezuela, Mr. Trump said, a group. But the president spoke at length in the news conference about American oil companies remaking the country's energy infrastructure and, presumably, regaining rights they had once held to Venezuela's vast oil reserves. Mr. Trump, in the Saturday morning interview, declined to throw his support behind Maria Corina Machado, the Venezuelan opposition leader who has recently won the Nobel Peace Prize to succeed Mr. Maduro as president. Ms. Machado posted a statement on social media calling for the national unity following the capture of Mr. Maduro. Given his refusal to accept a negotiated exit, the government of the United States has fulfilled its promise to enforce the law, she wrote. We have struggled for years. We have given it our all, and it has been worth it. What had to happen is happening. The Venezuelan Communication Ministry said in a statement that Venezuela rejects, repudiates, and denounces what it called U.S. military aggression. The statement also called on all social and political forces in the country to activate mobilization plans and repudiate this imperialist attack. The capture stunned many in Venezuela, despite Mr. Maduro's unpopularity. People flocked to supermarkets to stock up on water and food, anticipating shortages in the chaotic days to come. In an interview with the state television, Venezuela's Attorney General, Tarek William Saab, called on Venezuelans to take to the streets to oppose the U.S. action. We are going to show the world what we are made of, he said. In the heavily Venezuelan city of Doral, Florida, near Miami, expatriates rejoiced, blaring music before dawn, honking car horns, and dancing Viva Venezuela Libre. One man waving a Venezuela flag yelled as he drove by El Arapazo, a Venezuelan arepa shop in a gas station where Venezuelans often gather for political or sporting events. Other reactions from inside the United States and around the world were divided, largely along political lines and international alliances. The top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut, said that while Mr. Maduro was an illegitimate ruler, there was no evidence he posed a threat that justified military intervention. The administration must immediately brief Congress on its plan to ensure stability in the region and its legal justification for this decision, he said. Senator John Thune, the Republican majority leader, said the capture of Mr. Maduro was an important first step to bring him to justice for drug crimes for which he had been indicted in the United States, and called on the operation a decisive action by Mr. Trump. The governments of Ecuador and Argentina and others sympathetic to the United States praised the operation, while China, Iran, and Russia condemned it. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, said in a statement that he was alarmed by the events. Independently of the situation in Venezuela, these developments constitute a dangerous precedent, the statement said. Mr. Guterres was deeply concerned that the rules of international law had not been respected. The commando raid, the riskiest U.S. military operation of its kind since members of the Navy SEAL Team 6 killed Mr. bin Laden in a safe house in Pakistan in 2011, was conducted days after the CIA carried out a drone strike on a port facility in Venezuela. It also came amid a legally disputed campaign that has destroyed boats and killed more than 100 people in the waters around Latin America in an effort to increase pressure on Mr. Maduro. The raid capped off months of threats, warnings, and accusations of drug smuggling from Mr. Trump and his cabinet, all centered on Mr. Maduro, whom the State Department has called the head of a narco-terrorist state. U.S. officials have accused him of controlling criminal groups tied to drug trafficking, charges he denied. Since late August, the Pentagon has amassed an armada of a dozen ships in the Caribbean. The arrival of the aircraft carrier Gerald R. Ford and three missile-firing Navy destroyers in November added about 5,500 military personnel to a force of 10,000 troops already in the region, roughly half ashore in Puerto Rico and half at sea. With more than 15,000 military personnel, the U.S. buildup is the largest in the region since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Last month, Mr. Trump called a massive armada and said that he was planning action on land in Venezuela soon. In the days leading up to the raid, the U.S. sent increasing numbers of special operations aircraft, specialized electronic warfare planes, armed Reaper drones, search and rescue helicopters and fighter jets, last-minute reinforcements that military analysts said indicated the only question was when the military action would happen, not if. Despite its buildup of forces, the Pentagon has not positioned enough troops to mount any sort of invasion of Venezuela. The raid to capture Mr. Maduro constituted Mr. Trump's latest unilateral exercise of power. He had no explicit authorization from Congress, where a bipartisan group in the Senate has been promoting legislation to try and rein in his authority to engage in hostilities inside Venezuela. Three separate policy goals have driven the administration's approach to Venezuela since earlier this year: crippling Mr. Maduro, using military force against drug cartels, and securing access to the country's vast oil reserves for U.S. companies. The goal to oust Mr. Maduro as the leader of Venezuela was an initiative that Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, has championed. Mr. Rubio has cast Mr. Maduro, an autocrat, who has unleashed waves of violent repression, as an illegitimate leader who oversees the export of drugs to the United States. A secret order for military action against the cartels that Mr. Trump signed on July 25th, calling for maritime strikes, was the first known written directive from the president on such strikes. Administrative officials referred to the boat attacks as Phase 1, with SEAL Team 6 taking the lead. Policymakers at the time also discussed a vague Phase 2, with Army Delta Force units possibly carrying out land operations. The attack comes at a time of diminished transparency by the Pentagon, which the president renamed the Department of War, also without the authorization of Congress. Typically, the Defense Department has held large, strictly choreographed televised briefings on the unclassified details of major military attacks and deployments. None have been held on the Caribbean campaign. As the strikes against boats continued throughout the fall, Mr. Trump, Mr. Rubio, and Stephen Miller, a top White House aide overseeing immigration policy, moved on to the next stage of the campaign against Mr. Maduro, seizing oil tankers to deprive Venezuela of revenue. They insisted that Mr. Maduro must return oil and other assets, quote, stolen from the United States, before they lift what Mr. Trump has referred to as a blockade. In its first weeks, the tactic shook Venezuela's economy by paralyzing its oil industry. Critics called it gunboat diplomacy or, as Mr. Maduro put it, a warmongering and colonialist pretense. On Tuesday, the administration's pursuit of sanctioned vessels took a bizarre turn when the crew of an oil tanker fleeing U.S. forces in the Atlantic Ocean painted a Russian flag on the side of the vessel in an apparent attempt to claim Russian protection. Subway and bus fares rise by 10 cents in New York City, by Stefanos Chen. New year, new fare. On Sunday, the cost of taking the subway or bus in New York City will rise to $3 from $2.90 for most riders, the first increase in more than 2 years. The 10-cent increase is modest, less than 4% of the current fare, at a time when other public transit systems in the United States are adopting double-digit percentages increases. The Board of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, the state agency that controls the city's subway and buses and two commuter railroads, approved the increase in September. Transit officials delayed the imposition of the higher fare until the new year, partly because they first wanted to end sales of the MetroCard, which was retired at the end of December, in favor of the new Omni payment system. Prices also increased for other authority customers on Sunday. The cost of weekly and monthly tickets on Long Island Railroad and Metro North Railroad, which are based on distance traveled, will increase up to 4.5%. One-way fares will climb up to 8%. But accompanied minors 17 and under can now ride the two commuter railroads for $1. The previous age limit was 11. A trip using Access a Ride, the paratransit service, will also go up to $3 from $2.90. Tolls at the authorities' bridges and tunnels will increase about 7.5%. Most vehicles using the Queens Midtown Tunnel, for example, will climb to $7.46 from $6.94. The MTA expects the changes to raise $350 million a year in additional revenue. The authority relies on roughly $21 billion annual operating budget that uses primarily to pay worker salaries and benefits, utility costs, and borrowing expenses. More than a quarter of the budget comes from fares. Jano Lieber, the authority's chief executive, has credited Governor Kathy Hochul's financial support for the MTA with making the relatively small fare increase possible. The authority had typically raised the fare up to 4% roughly every 2 years, with an exception made in 2021 when the increase was postponed amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The latest fare increase will nevertheless make travel less affordable for a large share of commuters. 1 in 5 New Yorkers struggles to pay for public transit, according to a 2024 report by the Community Service Society, an anti-poverty group. A city-run program, Fair Fares, offers half-price trips to poor New Yorkers. Transit advocates have criticized the program's application process as burdensome and its income requirements as too restrictive. The most a family of four can earn and still qualify for the discount is around $48,000, far below the city's median household income. The fare increase arrives just as Mayor Zohan Mamdani, who campaigned on a promise to make the city buses fast and free, is considering ways to fully subsidize bus fares for all riders. Any plan would require cooperation with Ms. Hochul, who controls the transit system and would most likely have to raise taxes to finance such subsidies. Mr. Mamdani's free bus proposal comes at an inopportune time for the MTA, which has been focused on reducing fare evasion and increasing fare revenue as ridership inches closer to its pre-pandemic levels. After a steep decline at the height of the pandemic, subway ridership in 2025 rose to about 85% of those levels, the authority said. The MTA projects that annual bus fare revenue, including paratransit, could exceed $1 billion by 2028, a sum that could be difficult to raise from elsewhere in the state budget. Listening to a reading of articles and features from the front section of the New York Times on Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The Key, Thorny Issue of Security Guarantees, by Cassandra Vinograd and Constant Mattoon. Through every twist and turn in peace negotiations, President Vladimir Zelensky has made one thing clear. Ukraine will not lay down its arms without firm guarantees for its post-war security. The latest flurry of talks with the United States has brought the two sides closer than ever to an agreement that could satisfy Ukraine's insistence on Western protection against another Russian invasion. Still, even as Kyiv has drawn up an outline with the Trump administration, thorny questions remain. How the guarantees would work, which countries would provide them, and how long they would last. Ukraine seeks concrete answers to assuage worries about whether its allies would actually enter into a conflict with Russia in Kyiv's defense. President Trump has said that Europe would take the lead in guaranteeing Ukraine's future security. On Saturday, European national security advisors were in the Ukrainian capital to try to fill in some of the details in a draft peace plan. U.S. officials were expected to join remotely. The meeting will be the first of many in coming days to tackle the topic of security guarantees. Here's what you need to know. Why are security guarantees such a big focus? Ukraine's insistence on the guarantees is rooted in the bitter experience of seeing previous security assurances collapse when put to the test. The most painful example is the Budapest Memorandum, a pledge signed in the early years after Ukraine's independence from the Soviet Union. Under that 1994 accord, Ukraine transferred old Soviet nuclear weapons to Russia in exchange for security assurances from Russia, the United States, and Britain. China and France gave separate assurances of their own. The memorandum did not detail those guarantees and offered no promise of military support in case of an attack. Kyiv says the lack of specificity gave Russia free rein to invade Ukraine as it did first in 2014 and then with the full-scale invasion that began in 2022. That helps explain why Ukrainian officials now want clearly defined, legally binding guarantees before agreeing to end the war. What has been proposed? A recent draft of the peace plan said that the United States, NATO, and the European states would provide Ukraine with so-called Article 5-like guarantees, a reference to NATO's mutual defense clause, which requires its members to come to one another's aid in the event of an attack. The provisions outlined in the draft also include keeping Ukraine's army at a peacetime strength of 800,000 troops, with funding from Western partners, membership in the European Union, which Ukraine sees as a deterrent to Russia, European military support, and a bilateral security agreement with the United States voted on by Congress. The latest proposal was primarily developed by Ukraine and the United States. Now European allies must decide what exactly they are willing to provide, how and by when. The meetings in the coming days are designed to address these issues. Mr. Zelensky has said the European military support could come from the so-called Coalition of the Willing, a group of about 30 countries that have committed to strengthening Ukraine's post-war security by contributing to its air, land, and sea defenses. Some European countries have said they would be willing to deploy forces in Ukraine as part of that effort. Mr. Zelensky also wants a precise date for the Ukraine entry into the European Union, but it remains unclear whether the bloc would agree to provide one, given the complexity of its membership negotiations. The terms of a bilateral security deal with the United States have also not been ironed out, though Mr. Trump has already indicated that he would be unlikely to put troops in Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky has said that Mr. Trump offered guarantees lasting 15 years, while Ukraine wants them to be enforced for decades. The Kremlin has vehemently rejected any plan for a Western troop presence in Ukraine, and there has been little indication that it would agree to the peace proposal that Ukrainian, American, and European officials have been laboriously drafting for weeks. What happens next? A meeting Saturday of European National Security Advisors, held in Kyiv as a symbol show of support for war-torn Ukraine, appeared aimed at laying the groundwork for a meeting on Monday in France of leaders of the Coalition of the Willing. After that, Mr. Zelensky has said he hopes that another round of talks with the United States will take place and include Europe. While security guarantees are a major topic, they are not the only sticking point. Ukraine and the United States have also yet to agree on issues of territory, most crucially in the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine. A previous peace proposal drafted by Russia and the United States called for Ukrainian forces to withdraw from the areas of Donetsk that Kyiv still holds and turn them into a neutral, demilitarized zone. A compromise outlined by Mr. Zelensky in late December builds on that idea and calls for Russia to also pull its troops from the area it controls in Donetsk. New Office Encourages Public Input in New York, by Jeffrey C. Mays. Behind Mayor Zohan Mamdani's stunning electoral victory was a grassroots volunteer operation that saw 100,000 volunteers knock on 3 million doors and make 4.5 million calls to engage voters. Mr. Mamdani has announced that he wants to bring that level of public participation to City Hall. Sitting in Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn, he signed an executive order on Friday creating an Office of Mass Engagement to help New Yorkers participate in government decisions and to reach communities that have been marginalized from the process. Leading the effort will be Tasha Van Auken, who served as Mr. Mamdani's campaign field director and previously worked for former President Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. The new office will combine and reorganize several existing city agencies. "Working New Yorkers know what they need to thrive," Mr. Mamdani said. "Our job is to make sure government listens consistently and with real consequence." Ms. Van Auken said her goal was to bring together existing public engagement efforts that have been siloed in City Hall and to help build a government that works for all New Yorkers, invites them in, and treats their participation as consequential. Bringing the director of his political field operation to City Hall raised concerns from some critics that Mr. Mamdani was using the city government to aid a potential campaign for re-election. Representative Mike Lawler, a Republican in a Hudson Valley swing seat, said on social media that the arrangement would allow Mr. Mamdani to use taxpayer funds to have groups like the Democratic Socialists of America and Working Families Party essentially operate out of City Hall and have a continuous political campaign. Ms. Van Auken previously worked as an organizer for the Democratic Socialists of America and as deputy campaigns director for the Working Families Party. Both groups helped to drive Mr. Mamdani's victory. Susan Lerner, the executive director of Common Cause New York, a nonpartisan government watchdog group, said she did not share Mr. Lawler's concerns. She said she would rather see the energy from Mr. Mamdani's campaign used in government than driven by outside groups. Allies of Mr. Mamdani recently created Our Time for an Affordable New York City, a group that seeks to raise money and harness the volunteer energy created by Mr. Mamdani's campaign. I don't see it as a political operation, Ms. Lerner said. I see it as bringing energy into government. If done correctly, it does reinvigorate people's faith in government, and that it can be responsive. Mr. Mamdani dismissed the criticism from Mr. Lawler, who had considered running for governor this year. He noted that more than 2 million New Yorkers voted in the November general election, the highest since 1969, and argued that the turnout demonstrated that many people want to be engaged and are allowing themselves to believe in the possibility of city government once again. At the same news conference, Mr. Mamdani appointed his friend and close advisor, Ali Najmi, as chairman of the Mayor's Advisory Committee on the Judiciary. The group screens candidates for criminal and family court judgeships and makes recommendations to the mayor, who makes the appointments. Mr. Namji is an election and criminal defense lawyer who served as Mr. Mamdani's lawyer during the primary. He is also a co-founder of the Muslim Democratic Club of New York. Mr. Mamdani and the judicial selection process was too opaque and often based on who they know as opposed to the work that they do. Mr. Namji said he wanted to broaden and diversify the pool of applicants by reaching out to lawyers who work for indigent clients or children in family court. To those attorneys, Mr. Namji said, I want to tell you that I have opportunity to also become a judge. As lead counsel for Mr. Mamdani's transition, Mr. Namji urged the 400 people on the committee to sign a 5-page non-disclosure agreement. The confidentiality agreement, while not atypical, was much longer than that for former Mayor Eric Adams' transition, which consisted of a single clause in a larger code of ethics agreement. Ms. Lerner praised Mr. Namji as a serious and experienced attorney. She said she hoped to see a serious and transparent process to bring in new voices for the judiciary that emphasize skill and experience, irrespective of people's backgrounds. Study's Retraction Renews Weed Killer Concerns by Hiroko Tabuchi. In 2000, a landmark study claimed to set the record straight on glyphosate, a contentious weed killer used on hundreds of millions of acres of farmland. The paper found that the chemical, the active ingredient in Roundup, wasn't a human health risk despite evidence of a cancer link. Last month, the study was retracted by the scientific journal that published it a quarter of a century ago, setting off a crisis of confidence in the science behind a weed killer that has become the backbone of the American food production. It is used on soybeans, corn, and wheat, on specialty crops like almonds, and on cotton and in home gardens. The Environmental Protection Agency still considers the herbicide to be safe. But the federal government faces a deadline in 2026 to re-examine glyphosate's safety after legal action brought by the environmental, food safety, and farm worker advocacy groups. The EPA has also faced pressure to act on glyphosate from the Make America Healthy Again movement, led by supporters of the Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who once served as co-counsel in a lawsuit against Monsanto over exposure to Roundup. The 2000 paper, a scientific review conducted by three independent scientists, was for decades cited by other researchers as evidence of Roundup safety. It became the cornerstone of regulations that deemed the weed killer safe. But since then, emails uncovered as part of lawsuits against the weed killer's manufacturer, Monsanto, have shown that the company's scientists played a significant role in conceiving and writing the study. In the emails, Monsanto employees praised each other for their hard work on the paper, which included data collection, writing, and review. One Monsanto employee expressed hope that the study would become the reference on Roundup and glyphosate safety. The pharmaceutical giant Bayer acquired Monsanto in 2018 for $63 billion. In retracting the study last month, the journal Regulatory Toxicology and Pharmacology cited serious ethical concerns regarding the independence and accountability of the authors. Martin Vandenberg, the journal's editor-in-chief, said the paper had based its conclusions largely on unpublished studies by Monsanto. There were indications that the authors had received financial compensation from Monsanto for their work, he said. There was no disclosure of a conflict of interest on the part of the authors beyond a mention in the acknowledgments that Monsanto had provided scientific support. As a result, Dr. Vandenberg said he had, quote, lost confidence in the results and conclusions of this article, end quote. Brian Leakey, a spokesman for Bayer and Monsanto's involvement with the 2000 paper, did not rise to the level of authorship and was appropriately disclosed in the acknowledgments, and that the listed authors had full control over and approved the study's manuscript. He said that glyphosate was the most extensively studied herbicide in the past 50 years, and that the vast majority of published studies had no Monsanto involvement. The sole surviving author of the 2000 article, Gary M. Williams, who is a professor at New York Medical College, did not respond to requests for a comment. Traces of glyphosate have been detected in foods like bread, cereal, and snacks, and in the urine of both adults and children, though there are signs that levels in food have dropped after public pressure led some companies to stop applying glyphosate shortly before harvest, a practice that leaves behind more chemical residues. The World Health Organization International Agency for Research on Cancer in 2015 classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic to humans. This is a seismic, long-awaited correction of the scientific record, said Dr. Philip Landrigan, who is a pediatrician and epidemiologist and the director of the program in global public health at Boston College. Dr. Landrigan recently chaired an advisory committee for the global glyphosate study that found that even low doses of glyphosate-based herbicides caused leukemia in rats. It pulls the veil off decades of industry effort to create a false narrative that glyphosate is safe, he said. People have developed cancers, and people have died because of this scientific fraud. Laboratory tests first flagged potential risks posed by the exposure to glyphosate as far back as the early 1980s, and soon after, studies of Midwestern farmers exposed to herbicides start to show an increase in certain cancers. A U.S.-backed effort to eradicate coca fields in Colombia by spraying glyphosate from planes onto hundreds of thousands of acres of cropland led to widespread reports of illnesses among the residents. The 2000 paper declaring glyphosate safe was published against that backdrop. As the EPA faces its 2026 deadline to reconsider the safety of the weed killer, the agency's critics are likely to highlight that the retracted paper appears in the bibliography of past EPA risk assessment on glyphosate. The EPA should reopen the decision immediately, said Dr. Bruce Lamphere, an expert in environmental neurotoxins at Simon Fraser University outside Vancouver, who specializes in infant exposures. There also need to be consequences, real financial penalties that reflect medical costs and human suffering, he said. The EPA spokesman, Mike Battish, said the agency was aware of the article's retraction. He said that EPA's assessment of glyphosate's risk had not relied solely on the study and that the agency did not intend to rely on it going forward. It's our statutory obligation to ensure agency-approved chemicals and pesticides are totally safe for approved uses listed on the label based on rigorous gold standard science, Mr. Bastish said. Thousands of plaintiffs, including farmers and gardeners diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma, have sued Monsanto, alleging that Roundup caused their cancer, and that the company had covered up the risks. In an early case, a jury in California State Court awarded $289 million to Dwayne Johnson, a school groundkeeper, after concluding that glyphosate had caused his cancer. Monsanto, jury said, had failed to warn consumers of the risk. Since then, Bayer has paid out more than $10 billion to settle approximately 100,000 Roundup claims and faces the potential of further costly lawsuits and jury verdicts, giving the many thousands of people who may have been exposed. The settlements have not included admissions of liability or wrongdoing, and Bayer has continued to sell the product. Bayer has also pushed Congress to pass a provision that would effectively shield pesticide makers from potentially having to pay further damages to plaintiffs. The Trump administration recently urged the Supreme Court to hear a case that would also shield manufacturers from liability. The retraction points to a wider problem of research secretly funded by industries like tobacco and lead, said David Rosner, co-director of the Center for History and Ethics of Public Health at Columbia University. Shading the science to favor the corporate interest, he said, was likely the rule rather than the exception. Journals need to press scientists more forcefully to identify conflicts of interest, he said. Huge financial interests are at stake. The withdrawal of the 2000 paper came after two Harvard scientists, Sasha Kavarov and Naomi Oreskes, urged the journal to re-examine the article. They estimated in a recently published analysis that the 2000 paper was in the top 0.1% of cited academic literature on glyphosate. What was surprising, they said, was that the other researchers continued to cite the 2000 paper even after the emails were disclosed in litigation starting in 2017. This paper has been one of the most cited papers ever written on the topic of glyphosate safety, Professor Oreskes said. Ma'am Donnie t-shirts? Of course they're for sale, by Misty White Siddell. Before Zohan Mamdani completed the oath of office on Thursday, making him New York City's new mayor, his image had already begun popping up on t-shirts in souvenir shops across Manhattan, in stores more known for trinkets aimed at tourists than celebrating local politicians. During his campaign, Mr. Mamdani made a point of not selling merchandise. Instead, he gave away bandanas and other wearable items free or organized rallies where supporters could craft their own pro-Mamdani swag. Now, despite Mr. Mamdani's best efforts to encourage free merchandise, T-shirts celebrating his mayoral victory, priced from $10 to $25, have appeared on shelves. One design features the mayor's likeness across an American flag. Another has the words, Mamdani, New York, printed in the bold typeface of the local tabloid newspapers. It's the world we live in, said Sarah Wagabaza, 44, a Brooklyn resident and Mamdani supporter who was attending a block party near City Hall on Thursday in celebration of his inauguration. She said she was looking to purchase a Mamdani hat from a street vendor. Also in the area, Natalie Ray, 69, was on the hunt for a shirt to send to a relative in California, a sign, she said, that Mr. Mamdani's popularity transcended New York. It's more common to see national figures like President Trump and former President Barack Obama on shirts, with some of the designs even entering pop culture. Several vendors across New York said they would be stocking goods commemorating a mayor of the city for the first time. A lot of customers are asking for them, Din Islam, who was behind the counter of a storefront on Canal Street in Lower Manhattan, said of the Mamdani shirts that were stocked days ago. Seduzaman Tarafada, the manager of Big Apple Gift near Times Square, said the store had sold hundreds of Mamdani shirts since they were introduced in October. A selection of Mamdani Christmas ornaments, however, did not arrive in time for the holidays, he added. Intellectual property experts said that determining the legality of these t-shirts was not a simple matter. Politicians have a right to ownership of their likeness, but the public is also permitted to comment on politicians, allowing for a gray area. Some politicians have pursued legal action against merchandise producers, said Mark Reiner, head of the intellectual property group at the New York City-based firm Hand, Balanchine & Associates. He cited a 2004 lawsuit filed in response to a bobblehead toy depicting former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger of California. Mr. Reiner said that Mr. Mamdani could object to the use of his image or name under New York State's right of publicity law, but he would not be able to take action against shirts that criticized his political views or agenda. Mr. Mamdani is not the only person who may have a right to make a claim about the shirts, said Julie Zerbo, a lawyer and founder of the Fashion Law website. Photographers also have legal recourse if their images of Mr. Mamdani were used on the T-shirts designs without permission. Some businesses are already planning a wider rollout of products inspired by the new mayor. An assortment of bobbleheads, keychains, magnets, and hats are expected to arrive on local shelves in the next month. Chinatown Center Gift Shop is already stocking three Mamdani t-shirt designs after a shipment that landed earlier this past week nearly sold out. But one of the store's owners, Muhammad Huda, said that the sales following the initial excitement about Mr. Mamdani's inauguration will depend on his job performance. Mr. Huda said he was being cautious about stocking up on Mamdani merchandise after learning his lesson with shirts featuring Mr. Trump, which were a strong seller initially in 2024 before falling off. "I don't want to lose money like that," Mr. Huda added. Some shoppers visiting from outside the United States, however, were perplexed by the idea of purchasing a shirt featuring a local politician. Martina Moro, 21, visiting from Italy, said the closest thing she had seen back home were small figurines of politicians that were meant to make fun of them. Bernadette Casey, 62, from Prestwick, Scotland, said in her home country, never would anyone put the head of a local council on a t-shirt. Ms. Casey said she would not be picking up a Mamdani-inspired shirt. "I might buy one with the Statue of Liberty or Brooklyn Bridge," she said, "but definitely not with the mayor of New York City." For some, Nazi Loot is Value Beyond Historical by Milton Estero and Michaela Tofighi. Marie-Helene Gagasp never met her father, Jean Arabarn. He died in 1945, 2 months after she was born, and a year after he had been arrested for guiding Jews fleeing the Nazis across the French border into Spain. Arabarn lived in the Camus Cayogue, a small village of 100 people in France that was mainly home to sheep farmers. When the Gestapo arrested him, Arabarn began a lethal journey that would take him from concentration camp to concentration camp. For most of her life, Gagasby, 80, knew little about her father. Then she got a call from a volunteer for the Errolson Archives, a German organization dedicated to researching and returning items that were stolen from Holocaust victims. The volunteer had her father's wallet. He wanted to return it. In March, in the local town hall of Camus-Chigu, the director of the organization hand-delivered the leather pouch. Inside it was a picture of Sagaspe's mother, a receipt for a package, and a stamp. Sagaspe held the wallet to her face and cried. Marie-Ange Sagaspe, her daughter said, "For my mom, it was like meeting her father." Discussions about the restitution of Nazi loot often focus on high-profile art, whose return is not only a matter of justice, but can also be of a significant financial consequence. But for descendants of those who lost property, and often their lives in the Holocaust, missing items with little monetary value can carry vast emotional weight. Reclaiming them can feel like resurrecting family life that was lost to atrocity. The chair they sat on, the books they had, the candlestick they lit. That's where we pass down the history that they tried to erase during the Holocaust, said Agnes Peristegui, an international lawyer who specializes in restitution cases. In some instances, reunification results from a stranger's goodwill. In others, provenance research is led by organizations or museums. For Stephen Motner, the restitution of family items was also a matter of surprise. He had heard stories of his grandparents, Conrad and Anna, and assumed that the items left behind when they fled Grundlsee, a small Austrian village, were lost or destroyed. But in 2016, he received a message from the Austrian Museum of Folklife and Folk Art in Vienna. The Mottner collection was in the museum's possession. He was a direct heir, and it was wanted to return the items. The collection included the Mottner's original sheet music, some patterns of Conrad Mottner had designed for a particular type of dress popular in the Alps, Osserdi drindels, and a printed collection of folk art. It was surprising, and we were very emotional because, of course, it brought up this intriguing, often painful history that my family went through at that time, their grandson said. Claudia Spring, a provenance researcher for the museum and a historian who is now retired, led the effort of tracing back the Mottner's lineage. She wrote a dossier on the family after 2 years of research, which was presented to the Commission for the Provenance Research in Austria. It was very, very, very clear, without any doubt, that this was impounded, that it was not legal in the museum, and that it should be restituted, Spring said. But when Mottner and his cousin, the other identified heir, visited the museum to see their newfound possessions, they decided to donate the collection back to the institution. Now included in the Mottner collection is a placard that tells the full tale of theft, loss, learning, and legacy. Meeting Stephen and his family was the most important of my adult life, and I'm very, very grateful for that. This is emotional part, Spring said. The professional part is very important to do the provenance research. There's not, it's too late, we shouldn't do it anymore. This doesn't exist for me. Another family, the Glatsteins, had not been as successful as yet. Members believe they have located the family's shofar, a ram's horn trumpet blown to welcome the Jewish High Holy Days, in the town of Endeli, Hungary, where their relatives lived before the Holocaust. It was thought to have been hidden in the attic of a family home when the Nazis sent their relatives off to a concentration camp. Sharon Glatstein Levine has told researchers for the World Jewish Restitution Organization that she believes she found the item on display in a local library during a 2014 trip to the town. The family has not been able to reclaim the shofar, which is now believed is held by the family of a local historian. In May, Levine returned to Edele and tried to letter to enlist a town official to help, perhaps by arranging for the shofar to be transferred to the Hungarian Jewish Museum and Archives, and then lent to the United States, where the family in particular, her 97-year-old cousin, Erica Jacoby, could view it. But so far, there's been no response from the town, Jonathan Jacoby, Erica's son, said. The library did not respond to an email from the New York Times seeking comment. It's more than just an object, Levine said in a video she made about the shofar for the restitution organization. It's part of my family's history and heritage. Erica Jacoby remembers celebrating as a young girl the High Holy Days in Endeli with the ram's horn, but she had not seen it since she left Hungary as a teenager, surviving imprisonment in several concentration camps, including Auschwitz. One of my biggest pains is they stole everything, she said. Willie Court, a lawyer who specializes in restitution claims, said that families who pursue returns face obstacles. Legal assistance can be expensive, and without the help of a museum or professional researchers, tracking personal household items like silverware is difficult. Many items have been dispersed across borders without proper or any documentation, he said. I'm strongly inclined that is rather the exception than the rule that these items can be identified, he said. The archive that returned the wallet to the Sagaspi family had known decades ago, as the International Tracing Service focuses on possessions that were primarily confiscated from prisoners at the Dachau and Nuenengam concentration camps in Germany. Irabarn's wallet was in an envelope, but it had no identifier, like a name, date of birth, or prisoner's number. Instead, all the leather pouch contained was the stamp, the receipt, and the photo of the woman in a plastic holder, but written on the back of the photo was one clue, the town name Kamuchi. A volunteer with the archives called the village's town hall and asked the mayor if it could send over a photo with the hopes that townspeople would be able to identify the woman. It was not terribly difficult. Sagaspi's mother had been the mayor's great aunt. Florian Azoulay, at the time the director for the Arlesen Archive, then traveled from Germany to Kamouchige to deliver the wallet to Sagaspi in person, a reunion first recounted by Le Monde. "We've returned quite a bit of personal belongings in the last year. I think about 1,000, Azoulay said. "But this is one of the stories I think that moved me the most." Now Sagaspi keeps the wallet in her purse at all times. After it was returned, she and her daughter, Marie-Ange Sagaspi, decided to take a trip retracing Iberon's path in France and Germany. They visit Compiègne, where he was first detained in France, and later in Neuengamme. Their final stop was the site of the mass graves for laborers at Hanover Stocken, where a sub-camp of Neuengamme had been located and where Erebarn died. "Our greatest victory was bringing that wallet back to the place it was taken from when he was alive," Marie-Ange Sagaspi said. "We brought him back as a free man." "Ranchers are burning the prairie to save it from trees," by Sachi Kitajima Mulkey. Sarah Grimm's ranch near Bone Steel, South Dakota, is a ruggedly beautiful place. Three generations of her family have grazed cattle on the pleated hills of prairie grass that slope down to the Missouri River, winding toward the broad horizon like a painter's brushstroke. In 2016, she and her husband, Rich, decided to set it ablaze. "I was scared out of my mind. We were losing sleep," Ms. Grimm said. "In this country, fire was a bad word." Eastern red cedar trees had grown so thick that the Grimms were having trouble riding horses through the pastures, let alone managing their cattle. They hoped the flames, in what's known as a prescribed burn, would halt the spread of the evergreens taking over their land. For decades, eastern red cedar has crept across plains states, earning it the regional nickname the Green Glacier. Its spread has come at the cost of native grasslands, which are one of the most endangered kind of biomes in the world, and has squeezed the land available for livestock. The carefully planned burn in 2016 worked so well that the Grimms have since burned two more sections of the ranch, totaling hundreds of acres. "We're never, ever going to get all of the trees," Ms. Grimm said, "but the progress we've made has been unbelievable." The fire was the first burn run by the Mid-Missouri River Prescribed Burn Association, a nonprofit group started after Dave Steffen, a retired conservationist who died in 2021, approached Ms. Grimm and offered to survey her land. Shortly after, Ms. Grimm joined him and six others in founding the group, which was modeled after well-established burn associations in Nebraska and Oklahoma. With the support of conservation groups, the state and universities, the group has conducted more than two dozen burns across nearly 9,500 acres. In any given year, it has 50 to 75 paying members. In the past 2 years, two additional prescribed burn associations have formed in other parts of the state. The broad conversion of prairie to farmland for row crops like wheat and corn over the past century caused a decline in native grasslands. In the 1930s, the Dust Bowl storms prompted the federal government to plant large numbers of eastern red cedar to break up wind in the region. The gradual spread of the trees has squeezed native grasslands ever since. "The numbers are just staggering," said Dirac Tidwell, a professor of rangeland ecology at the University of Nebraska, who has studied the benefits of burn associations. Together, agriculture and red cedars were responsible for 10 million acres of lost prairie between 2008 and 2016, according to data from the United States Department of Agriculture. While red cedar succumbs to fire, the natural prairie ecosystem thrives after a burn. Many native plants have evolved deep root systems and seed adaptations that help diverse grassland ecosystems bounce back, Dr. Tidwell said. Before settlers began suppressing fire in the late 19th century, native tribes in the region had long used it to manage the land. Bison are known to seek out young grass in burn scars, while various bird species flock to forage in the open spaces. Prescribed burns also clear away excess plant material while killing mature cedars and seedlings alike, reducing the risk of uncontrollable wildfire. "A lot of people think all trees are good," and removing them is bad, said Sheldon Fletcher, a water quality coordinator for the Lower Butte Lakota tribe. But it's not supposed to be forest here. Removing the trees is difficult. Many ranchers previously resorted to mechanically shearing them, a slow and expensive process that can scatter seeds. Shortly after one such attempt, Mr. Fletcher found saplings growing. We always joke that if you cut one big cedar tree, 100 little ones will grow up to the funeral, said Shane Reese, a ranch owner and conservationist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Mr. Fletcher and Mr. Reese co-founded the River Breaks Prescribed Burn Association, which is the only one in the state that represents both tribal and non-tribal land. The economic benefits of burning are very convincing to ranchers, said Tom Hausman, who works with the South Dakota State University Extension to establish burn associations in the state. That's in part because more cattle can occupy fire-treated land without overgrazing. Thanks to a combination of shearing and prescribed fire, the rent value of his own land has doubled in 10 years. Burn associations receive conservation funding, pooling their resources, and provide equipment to keep costs low for landowners. Experts employed at the University Extension also provide free workshops, training, and hands-on support to association members. All of the associations in South Dakota require landowners to participate in at least one burn before scheduling one on their own land. Sean Kelly, a range field specialist at the Extension, said this step is essential. The job of an association is to educate landowners so it can be a rancher helping a rancher, landowner helping a landowner, Mr. Kelly said. This is a not-for-hire service. Fires have to be conducted under the right conditions, and the burn season typically runs from March to May, when the moisture level in the trees is appropriate for burns and the surrounding vegetation is dormant. Landowners prepare months in advance by cutting associated-approved fire breaks, which are perimeters mowed around the intended burn area to reduce flammable vegetation. There's a real science to it, said Daniel Johnson, chairman of the Southeast Dakota Prevention Burn Association, which began in 2023 and now has 25 members. Scheduled burns are canceled if the weather conditions, like weather and humidity, aren't perfect. Sparks or flames leaping beyond the intended burn zone can be disastrous. An estimated 1 in every 1,000 prescribed fires ends up escaping containment, according to U.S. Forest Service. Heather Hammerbeck is a fourth-generation rancher in Lyman County and a member of the Mid-Missouri River Prescribed Burn Association Board. She was inspired to join after participating in the 2023 burn on Ms. Grimm's property, but is still waiting for her own burn to be scheduled. That's because the legal agreement allowing the group to perform prescribed burns on state-owned lands, which are ranched by many of the association's members, was revoked in 2024. The decision was made by the South Dakota Department of Public Safety and the State Game, Fish, and Parks Agency, which cited concerns about the complexities of the burns. You have been reading a selection of articles and features from the New York Times Sunday, January 4th, 2026 issue. We read from the front section of the New York Times every Sunday at 1. Your reader has been Jean, and thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the New York Times opinion page. Following that, at 3 o'clock, the New York Times Arts and Leisure. And at 4 o'clock, a rebroadcast of this morning's Buffalo News. Radio Reading mails out a large print program schedule to our listeners every other month. If you have not received a Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service large print program schedule in the mail, please call us at 716-821-5555. We will make sure that you receive one every other month. A Braille version of the schedule is also available upon request. Our number again is 716-821-5555. Thank you. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another